Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the former Secretary of Labour, Robert Reich, and discuss the austerity trap that the economy is stuck in with political gridlock and election politics digging the hole deeper. However, there is some reason to hope that as the powerful and privileged 1% try to take us back to the Gilded Age, a movement forming might rally the nation to reclaim the American dream for the 99%. Then we will look into the shameful growth of student debt that will reach $1 trillion this year. David Halperin, who is the Director of Campus Progress at the Center for American Progress, joins us to explain the increasing debt load students are now burdened with as they face a shrinking job market, and how lobbyists for the for-profit college industry have managed to get Congress to have taxpayer money charged back to unwitting students at exorbitant rates for a worthless education and a useless diploma. Then finally, we'll talk about drone warfare and the inevitable blowback that will come as the U.S. loses its technological edge and other nations develop their own drones. David Courtwright, the Director of Policy Studies at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at Notre Dame University, joins us to discuss the future implications of the proliferation of remote-controlled killing machines. Joining us now is Robert Reich, the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. He has served in three national administrations, most recently as Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration, and his latest book is Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Reich.
Hello, Ian. How are you?
Very well, thanks. And I don't know whether you watched the Republican debate. I know you wrote about it and how much free airtime they're getting and they're also getting quite a lot of viewers. But I must say it's beginning to look a bit like a kind of reality show like the Jersey Housewives. You know, you've got the pizza man throwing out all these zany ideas, and Ron Paul is like the crazy old uncle that everybody's trying to shut him up. But what I find most disturbing, though, is the audiences. They booed a gay veteran. They cheered at the prospect of pulling the plug on someone without health insurance. And then they cheered Herman Cain, who blamed the unemployed for being out of work.
Well, this all goes back to social Darwinism of the late 19th century, and that's where a lot of the Republicans want to take us back to, the era where the notion was survival of the fittest. You don't help anybody in need, so they said at the time, because that will just make them even lazier. The rich need to have more rewards so that they will work even harder, and the poor and needy need to have fewer rewards so they will perish, and so that the nation will be stronger. And that's essentially social Darwinism, and that's really what many of the Republicans are preaching and what some of their followers believe.
So does this explain why our culture is getting crueler and coarser?
Well, not everybody in the culture, in the society, agrees with social Darwinism, Ian. I think it's a very small portion of the public. I mean, the Tea Partiers, to the extent that they agree with it, are a very tiny portion of the American public. I think most people understand that we all rise or fall together, that we have to pull together if we're going to get through anything, whether it's Second World War or the Cold War or a economic depression or an economic recession. We are very good at rolling up our sleeves and working together. And I think this is what the Occupy Wall Street and the other Occupy LA and other Occupy centers are trying to put forward, a vision that we're just not a bunch of individuals premised on social Darwinism. We're actually linked together, and we need each other, and we have responsibilities toward one another.
And Robert Reich, the Occupy Wall Street, which is now spread across the country, and we have Occupy Los Angeles, you have Occupy Oakland up near you, and it's also spread around the world. It seems that the 99% versus the 1% is actually, I think, proving to be a very, very powerful unifying message. What's your sense, though, of the movement? Because it seems to me, as long as it deals with economic issues, it grows and it's bound to be more and more powerful, and it already has a lot of public support, several times more than the Tea Party does. But being on the left, there's a fear that it may get you know, sort of diffused by identity politics and other extraneous political issues. What's your analysis of that?
Ian, inevitably there's going to be some of that. I don't know where the occupier movement is going. I don't think anybody does, even in the so-called movement. In fact, I'm not even sure it's a movement yet. It could be. It needs probably the next stage will be more discipline and a little bit more specificity, not too specific. But I've already sensed a change in the tenor of public debate as a result of the Occupy Wall Street movement. That is, in fact, I was just in Washington last week, and I, in a lot of conversations, you know, Washington is just a series of meetings, basically, but several times, Democrats and even some Republicans brought up the question of inequality and concentration of income and wealth in various conversations. Now, that would never have been brought up without the occupier movement having made it an issue, a broad issue, even though it's not very specific and the demands are not very well articulated or articulated at all. But even the issue is now ripe in a way that it wasn't ripe 5 or 6 weeks ago.
So in terms of the 1% versus the 99%, do you think that that we are at a changing point? Because for a while there, it felt like that some of the traditional virtues of, you know, that go back to the pioneering days of shared sacrifice and neighborliness. I can't even pronounce the word. Neighborliness, et cetera, seem to have been replaced by, you know, maybe it goes back to Ayn Rand, the idea that altruism is terrible and selfishness is a virtue. But I sense that there's something changing in the zeitgeist here about.
Well, I think what's changed is Americans are hurting. Most people are, you know, sense that the dice are loaded. The game is rigged in some way. I mean, how is it that the top executives of the biggest corporations and the top executives of Wall Street, whose depredations have brought on much of the disaster that we're still living through, how can they be doing so well? Why is it that we bailed out Wall Street taxpayers, and yet we didn't bail out or help a lot of the people who desperately need help? Why is it that we can't even raise taxes, even slightly, on people who are at the top, who've never taken home, at least in 80 years, such a large portion of national income and wealth, and who face now the lowest tax rates than they faced since the 1980s, since Ronald Reagan? Why, you know, the reason, the answer for all of that has to do with the fact that power goes with wealth and income. And I think that the progressive urge in America, the progressive ideal, is insulted by what is going on. I think that the Occupy movement is a response to this lurch toward something that is very un-American and that most people are very uncomfortable about.
So do you think that that in a way this not so much the Wall Street movement, but the Wall Street itself in terms of the way it has created this illusion of talent and reward, and we know that they took us to the brink of economic collapse, and yet subsequently after the taxpayers bailed them out, they've rewarded themselves and the bonuses keep going. But there's a culture out there in corporate America amongst CEOs, and you point out in your recent writing that CEOs in the 1970s were paid 40 times the average worker's wage, and now they receive 300 times a typical worker's wage. And there's a really very disturbing book called Retirement Heist by Ellen Schultz, a Pulitzer Prize-winning veteran reporter from the Wall Street Journal. Really analyzing with absolute clarity that what's been going on in this country is that corporate America has literally been stealing the pension money from the workers and essentially handing it over to executives.
Well, Ian, it's been going on for quite some time now. I mean, for at least two or three decades, this growing arrogance on Wall Street and in top corporate suites. I mean, the Bank of America hit by a credit downgrade last month, has just moved its risky derivatives from its Merrill Lynch unit to a subsidiary that's flush with insured deposits of you and me and other people. I mean, this continues to go on, these kind of shenanigans. And I think, quite honestly, most Americans are fed up with it. They're fed up with the unequal power. They're fed up with the dice being loaded against them. They're fed up with a system that is not designed any longer to respond to the needs of ordinary people, and a democracy that is a democracy, unfortunately, more and more in name only, that is dominated by money and money coming from very powerful moneyed interests. The occupiers have tapped into something that is very, very large and very deep right now. And every time in this country, we have been challenged profoundly by a sense that the economy and our democracy are in jeopardy, whether we're talking about the progressive era between 1900 and 1916, or we're talking about the New Deal, or what happened in the 1960s, the Great Society, and so forth, or we're talking about more recently, I mean, even the environmental movement. What happens is Americans get together and they allow common sense to prevail. They don't want these radical right-wing Ayn Rand ideas to dominate. That's not America.
Well, America, a lot of our mythology is about a meritocracy, and that's the part of it that I find extraordinary, is that somehow these people in this rarefied atmosphere of the top corporate suites in this country have created this illusion that they have peculiar talents and that they can go from one day they can manage a pineapple canning factory and the next day they can buy an aerospace company or be CEO of an aerospace company. And just recently up near where you are, Robert Reich, the HP, Hewlett Packard, hired a guy, gave him a $10 million signing bonus. He only lasted 10 months, I think, as the CEO. And then they gave him another $10 million to go out the door. And in order to pay for all of these packages that they threw at this guy that they were essentially firing, I think they had to lay off like 1,400 workers.
Well, not only do people lose their jobs, but consumers pay more. Small investors don't get the returns that small investors need for their pension plans. The more we have the game rigged toward people at the top, where more and more of the income and wealth moves to the top, the more everybody else just doesn't get forward. I mean, we're seeing median wages now declining rapidly. Incomes, family incomes are going down. And here's the thing that really, when I looked at the data, I was struck. Ian, 37% of all families with young children in the United States are now in poverty. 37%. That's the highest record level of poverty among families with children, with young children. 37%. I mean, here we're living in a society now, the richest society we have had ever. I mean, America is vastly rich, but we have the top 1%. Now taking home over 20% of total national income. We have the top 1% taking home and sitting on 35% of the total wealth of the nation. Let me just give you one further data point. I know the data eyes glaze over, but these are such powerful realities. The 400 wealthiest families in America are now sitting on more wealth and have more wealth than the bottom 150 million people in the United States. I mean, things are so skewed, bizarrely skewed, and the power that is now centralized in people like the Koch brothers or people who are abusing that power to manipulate our political process, this just can't go on. And I think most Americans, they don't have to be lefty or right-wing. They don't have to have a political identification or an ideology. They just look at this and they say, this is insane. This is not the America I know any longer. I can't in good conscience sit back and do nothing about it. I've got to be active. I've got to, if nothing else, I've got to demonstrate. And that's exactly what's beginning to happen.
Well, Robert Reich, we seem to be marooned in a peculiar netherworld between economic realities that are dire and political possibilities that are dismal. And you have written in your latest piece, The Austerity Death Trap, indicating that we actually may, the hole may be being dug further, because if the Republicans don't agree to a budget deal before the end of the year, and, you know, records indicate that that's highly likely that they won't, the temporary payroll tax cuts and extended unemployment benefits we have now will end. And with these ongoing cuts of state and local government at every level, this fiscal contraction, we've seen it happen in the UK, the writing is on the wall. So as we shrink our economy, as we shrink demand even further, because the real issue is to create demand. It's not, you know, the corporate America may be sitting on tons of money, but there's nobody going to the malls to buy anything. So we seem to be in this situation where as the economy shrinks, then the debt that everybody seems to be so concerned about, it gets worse.
Yeah, we find ourselves in a vicious cycle. If people don't have enough money to buy things because they're worried about their jobs and their wages, then companies can't expand. In fact, companies actually have to go abroad. But even the foreign markets are beginning to shrink. China, demand in China is shrinking, and also Europe is in its own debt crisis, and Japan, of course, is flat on its back. So you have an entire global economy that is in the throes of a kind of austerity trap. And we in the United States, of all places, know, and we have followed the basic rule for years, that if people don't have enough money to work, if they are not paid a decent salary, they can't turn around and keep the economy going. And so when so much income and wealth goes to the top, Ian, and we're now seeing the results, when so much income and wealth goes to the top, then the vast middle class and working class and poor of America don't have the purchasing power to keep the economy going on their own without going deep and deeper and deeper into debt. And, of course, that's not sustainable. So you see, this system that we have right now is itself not sustainable. Not only in environmental terms, it's not sustainable even in economic terms. People at the very top, the very rich, would be better off with a smaller share of a rapidly growing economy than they are with a very large share of an economy that's dead in the water. Now, when are they going to realize it? Well, I don't think they're going to realize it on their own. That's why I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic about the occupier movement. I'm optimistic about the common sense of Americans. We have an election coming up. I think that people are waking up.
Well, indeed, the trap that that Spain's in, where the unemployment, 44 out of 100 young Spaniards are out of work. Little wonder they formed these encampments, which in many ways became the inspiration for the Occupy Wall Street movement. And you're suggesting in your recent writing that whenever privilege and power conspire to pull us backwards, the nation eventually rallies and moves forward. And I take it that that the sense is that this 99% movement may be what's kickstarting a new movement. Now,
it may be, Ian. We just don't know. I think that it's already had the effect, as I said before, of changing the tenor of debate a little bit in Washington, which means that, you know, Washington, although it's an echo chamber, it's a bubble, it does pay attention when a lot of Americans begin marching or demonstrating or when something seems to be happening and spreading. And so Washington is listening. Washington is watching. And that itself is a huge victory.
Thank you so much for joining us.
So I will talk to you soon, I hope.
You certainly will. Thank you.
Okay.
And so just speaking then with Robert Reich, the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California in Berkeley. He served in three national administrations, most recently Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. His latest book is Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment.
Giving us a squeeze. Let's raise our glasses to Mr. Bonet.